Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hi, this is Craig. Just want to let you know you can now advertise here on Everyone Loves Guitar podcast. For more information, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. And I've got a great guest today. I've been looking forward to talking with Charlie Gilbert because I had the pleasure of meeting him in person in Nashville. Well, it was definitely last year, but it was like, because this is January 3rd as we're recording this. But it was, I think, in the spring or maybe, I don't know, the fall. I don't know. But he's one of the nicest guys I've met. And it was interesting because he's one of these guys. He's completely unassuming and, you know, just a very sweet guy. And then he said, hey, man, he goes, I want you to have my CD. And I was like, okay, thank you. And I didn't have a lot of time and I never have time, but I was, you know, we had talked a few more times, I think. And I was like, man, I really like this guy. He's nice. I said, let me check out his CD. So I listened to his CD and good Lord, I was like blown away, man. He's like a ninja, you know, like on guitar. He's like one of these guys, you don't see him, but he's going to kill you once he pulls out his guitar. So I'm really happy to have Charlie Gilbert. And I think I know everybody's going to like him. And I would hope you check out his music. He's an incredible guitar player. Very talented, not just as a player, but as a songwriter as well. So let me tell you about Charlie Gilbert. He's an accomplished guitarist, songwriter, and producer. He's based out of Nashville, plays many genres, including blues, bluegrass, which is incredibly difficult, country, modern jazz, and rock. He's had the opportunity to work with some pretty big names in the industry, including David Hungate from Toto, Larry Blackman from Cameo, Carmine Appice from Vanilla Fudge, Beck Bogart and Appice, Rod Stewart and Cactus, Tony Franklin, of course, great bass player for Jimmy Page and Paul Rogers, Gilmore and Whitesnake, Brian Scoggin from Casting Crowns, Chris Hicks from the Marshall Tucker Band, Chris Cagle, and Tom Leadon from Tom Petty's band. In 2010, Charles was signed to his first recording contract. Is it okay if I call you Charlie or do you prefer Charles?
All my friends call me Charlie.
Yes, all right, please. Great. In 2010, Charlie was signed to his first recording contract under Global Maximus Records with his former band Bad Horse. In 2012, the song It's All Good, which was co-written by Charlie, was featured during the NFL Alumni Awards. The next year, several songs Charlie co-wrote and arranged with Bad Horse were included on the soundtrack for the feature film Brother's Keeper. That same year, the song Game Face, also co-written by Charlie, was featured on the Vince Lombardi Awards. He's currently working on original music for the up-and-coming animated television show called Groupies. That's Groupeez. In January 2018, he released his debut instrumental album called Tall Tales. That's the album I'm talking about. You need to listen to. And you can currently find him in the studio or on tour with some of Nashville's up-and-coming artists or in the studio overseeing production of his new album slated for release in 2019. And that album is called 2020?
That's just when it's going to come out. We don't know what it's called yet.
Okay, it's going to come out in 20. All right, great. Man, thank you so much for coming on the show. I've been looking forward to talking with you.
Oh, thanks, Craig. Actually, we met the week of NAMM.
Right.
It was we met at the luncheon at the Nashville the community
Nashville Guitar Community, right? Matthew Lee's group. And that was probably so. That was summer, August, yep, I guess, summer. Right? Yeah, yep. That's right, man. Hey, what? One of the reasons I really wanted to have you on the show is because you've got a great story. As you're a great example of a solo guy making it successfully as a musician, and you're putting out records and you're putting them out without spending a ton of money, and they're great and incredible records. And I think you're a really good example for people to hold up, to look at for those people who say, hey, I can't do a record for, you know, X, fill in the blank, whatever that is. And I was really impressed with the quality of the work you did, the musicianship, the recording, and just the tenacity you had to make it happen. And then to go back and do a round two that you're doing now, I was just, to me, it showed me a lot about your character. So I think I want everybody to pay attention to you know, the path and how Charlie's connecting the dots here. So talk about your first album, Tall Tales. How the heck did you make such an amazing record on such a low budget, man? Because you were telling me, and I was just like, it's an incredible record.
Well, I'll tell you, I appreciate you saying all the kind words. It really means a lot. The mindset came from a piece of advice my mom gave me when I was really young. She said, don't be afraid to ask for help. You know, that was, the men in my family are very prideful and we don't ask for help a whole lot. And she just told me that a lot. And, you know, I had some really good musician friends around me and I just was like, I really want to do this. And they offered to help. You know, I told them I wanted the help and they offered. So the biggest thing is don't be afraid to ask people around you for help. Now, the second record's a little bit different. You know, I'm on a trail to put money together and everything. Cause I don't want to take advantage of nobody. That's never my intentions. But the big thing was, just finding the right people. And luckily the right people were there already kind of in place. Like, Leroy Wilson, the drummer, who was just ridiculous, man. I mean,
guys, insane, man.
Yeah. Really good. And, Anthony East, they're both out of the Atlanta area. He teaches at Atlanta Institute of Music, and he's the bass. I think he's the head bass guy there now. So just awesome player. My buddy Quankatir Marshall, he lives in the Middle East now, and he actually cut a lot of those synthesizer parts while he was overseas. He teaches abroad. So he sent a lot of tracks over afterwards. And so I had those three guys in my corner. Leroy was kind of funny because when I brought in this music, he was kind of like, so he played along to it. I'm having him stretch out and do all this crazy stuff. And I said, what do you think? He's like, I think it's too much. I was like, really? Because there really wasn't a lot of musical content there. It was just kind of the skeleton.
Yeah.
And then finally, 6 months later, 8 months later, I bring in the guitars and all that. And he's like, this is a great record. You know, he was really excited about it because he could hear what I was having him do actually meant something. But back to your original question, don't be afraid to ask for help. You know, I'm doing it again with a second record. I'm trying to raise money. I decided to take it in three stages this time. I think last time I sold a guitar. You have a guitar in the background there. It's a Les Paul. I used to have one that looked just like that.
Classic, yeah.
And I think I paid $1,500 for mine, and I sold it to a really close friend back home for $1,500. So that went towards printing the record. That went towards. So you might have to give up some gear too along the way. So just depending on how bad you want it. If you want something bad enough, you'll do whatever it takes. So,
man, and I want to endorse and second that. How important it is, don't be afraid to ask for help. Because I have two regrets in my life, and one of them, to be 100% honest with you, is that I never asked for help. I'm 55, maybe about 4 or 5 years ago I started. And it had nothing to do with pride. It's a long story, but that is, if I wish I had asked for help when I was 25 years old or whatever, and because I never mind giving help, you know, most people don't mind helping. So I think everybody listening, boys and girls, if you learn nothing today, ask for help. Don't be afraid to ask for help. That's what Charlie's mom said, and she's 100% right.
Absolutely.
Hey, how did you wind up getting your song featured during the NFL Alumni Awards and on the Vince Lombardi Awards?
Well, so the NFL alumni deal, in the band Bad Horse, one of the members, kind of the leader of the band, one of the leaders in the band, his dad... that was Robert Walden, and then his dad's name was Robert Walden as well, Senior, and he went by the name Big Toe from Tahoe, and he played for the Steelers, and was best friends with Bobby Bradshaw.
Okay.
And
so Bobby Bradshaw or Terry Bradshaw?
Terry Bradshaw, excuse me. And so I guess Terry Bradshaw was actually Robert's godfather. Oh. So he had this connection in with the football deal. And so he was like,
and Terry used to be a, wasn't he doing like country? Wasn't he a country singer at one point in time? Right. Okay. That's back in my memory bank.
Well, I'd actually quit that band. And shortly after, they did a music video for that song, It's All Good. And Terry's actually in that video.
That's funny.
So I guess with that connection, they got connected there. And then the other tune, Game Face, I recorded. Well, I didn't record anything with that. I actually just co-wrote it with a guy named Gannon Adams. And I can't remember the other fellow's name off the top of my head right now. But the guy who is managing him is Jason Aldean's dad.
Okay.
So
there's enough nepotism just in this one story, man.
Well, you know, I'm from Georgia originally, and it's like the southern rock and country realm of the world. I'm from a little town called Newton, Georgia, which housed Alan Jackson and Doug Stone. And, you know, I was always surrounded by people in it, but in the country realm. So I got that, and Gannon actually went on to the Vince Lombardi Awards. And there was actually, I think there's a video out there somewhere of him performing the song. So that's how that guy, it's just, you know, connecting with people and networking and working on the song. And that song got picked out amongst, I think, three other songs that were presented to be on.
That's awesome.
So, yeah.
And now you're doing this animated TV show called Groupies. So obviously you kind of like the licensing thing and you're trying to do more work in it.
Well, I can't say that I like it because I've not done a terrible amount of it. I've kind of fallen into it on accident. It's not something I've ever went after. Hmm. It's not something that I really am that knowledgeable about. But a friend of mine back home, he's a really interesting guy. He's like he's definitely the jack of all trades. Like, he gets into everything. And it's just crazy. He's this weird entrepreneur. He's one of my best friends. His name is Charles as well. My wife's name is Sarah. His wife's name is Sarah.
That's weird.
So we're the Charles and Sarah group. And he started this show idea called Groupies, which is originally called Roadies. And it's a cartoon show, and it's centered around musicians and music and everything. And he's like, hey, man, why don't you start a band and write this, you know, music for this show, and I'll, you know, put it in the show eventually. I was like, sure. Then I find myself helping him write the first pilot for it. So I'm also writing content for the show.
That's cool.
And so right now he's in the place of raising money. I think they've got a lot of different artists that are wanting to be on the show as of now. So I've got two songs in the can that are done. They're mastered and everything. I have to send them to you. They're pretty funny, and I'm singing. Everybody says I sound like a wannabe Jack Black. But Leroy, he's playing drums on one. A buddy named Sketchamon's playing drums on another, and then I'm playing all the instruments afterwards. And I'm accidentally falling into it. I know nothing about what I'm doing. I have no advice on how to get there other than just make a lot of friends.
Yeah. Hopefully that keeps happening. And at some point, you probably know what you're doing, and then you can actually, you know, do what you want with it. That's great, man. Congratulations. Sure. You've played with some monster artists. I'm going to just put out some names. And if you could tell me how you got the gig and if there's any cool or interesting stories about working with them or your experience around them. Carmine Appice.
So Carmine and Tony Franklin had this project with Kelly
Kagi from Night Ranger.
Yeah. Well,
no. Oh, you know, Kelly, the guitar player from Night Ranger.
Yeah.
Kelly Carey, I think.
Something like that. Yeah.
There's a lot of Kellys over there.
So he wrote this tune called Perfect Day, and they had brought it to whoever was, this lady named Sandy Surge out of Atlanta, who was representing. And I'm not sure. Is Kelly Keeley something?
No, it's Kerry Kelly or something like that.
Yeah. I'm going to get probably emails about it, you know. But she hit up my buddy Anthony, who's been a longtime friend and co-writer and everything. We've done a lot of music together, and said, hey, I want to do this pop version of this song that sounded like Soundgarden that Carmine and Tony had played on. So we get this tune, and we're like, okay, let's rip it apart and see what we come up with. So Anthony starts writing all this stuff around it with acoustic, And next thing I know, here I am. We're trading emails from Carmine and Tony from California to Atlanta. I never actually got to be in the room with those guys. Mm-hmm. I just got to play on the recording with them. It was all remote session. But there was three versions of the song that were recorded. And of course, you have the one that's out called Perfect Day. And it's kind of like a Coldplay-ish type thing, I guess. And that's what they wanted to go for. But the first two that were recorded were like a Eric Johnson. It was really heavy guitar. Mm. And you could tell that we were all inspiring one another. There's like really cool drums and bass all over it. And they're like, nah, you got to calm it down. We've got to do, you know, more of a pop version. And it got released. And, you know, I got to say I worked with those guys.
Very cool. So you were emailing back and forth with Tony Franklin?
Yeah, I wasn't personally. But just like I said, I just got to be on the recording with the guys. And
very
I got
cool. Crazy yeah. world we work in. Like you can be on a recording with someone, never meet them, and, mm-hmm. and it's wild. And then Chris Hicks.
Chris Hicks, man. So
Chris is from this. Just Chris is a singer of Marshall Tucker Band.
That's right. Yeah. So when I got married in 2011, I moved to Warner Robins, Georgia, which is just a little south of Macon, Georgia. And of course, Macon, Georgia is like the capital of Southern Rock. Allman yeah. Brothers.
That's Otis where the Allman, the house, right? Isn't the house
yeah,
there?
Big yeah, big house.
The big house, right.
So the drummer who played on my record, Leroy Wilson, and we'll probably mention his name 100 times because he's like a mentor to me.
Dude, just, you can. That guy is a monster. You can mention yeah. his name as many times as you want.
He's a very dear friend of mine, and I think a lot of him, he's been a mentor to me. But to get back to your question, Chris and Leroy were playing together. Chris has a side project called the Chris Hicks Band. And when he's not with Marshall, you know, he's doing that. Well, Chris brought Leroy. From what I understand, Chris can probably correct this, and Leroy probably could too. But they brought Leroy on for the Marshall Tucker Band to do some of the dual drumming. Okay, so Leroy started doing that, started playing with Chris. Those guys have been friends for quite a while. And then I joined a variety band with Leroy, and a show came up. And so Chris and I worked together on that. I think it was one or two times maybe that we've been on stage together doing that. And then just kind of became friends, you know, and he's come and set in, you know, on different shows. If I was playing with an artist, I'd be like, Chris, you know, me and Leroy, come on, Chris, come out and play. And of course he will. Chris will play anytime. You know, it's like he's always got an amp by his side.
He plays, he's not only just sings, he's a guitar player though.
God, he's one of the most soulful guitar players you'll ever hear.
Interesting. That's cool. There's some good players up there in Georgia, man.
Oh, dude. You know, Macon is like the mecca of Southern rock guitar players, man.
In Atlanta, there's a lot of good guys too.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. I mean, you got Chris Blackwell.
Tommy Talton.
Yeah, you got Barry.
All right, I got to hit Barry. Right, yeah. I was looking at his name this morning, funny enough.
Yeah, man.
So talk about, what are you working on now, Charlie, that you're excited about? I know it's your album. You want to talk about that?
Sure, yeah. So Tall Tales was released. The hard copy was released January 1st of 2018. So it's been a year since it's been out. And then I released it digitally in March, I believe it was. I think it was like March 2nd of this year. And it's done fairly well. I probably gave away more copies than anything because, I mean, nowadays you make music as a glorified calling card. You don't really make music expecting to make money.
Right.
So, and that's all well and good because of this record, it's got me a lot of other gigs. It's made me money in other areas outside of just making money off a physical disc. But with that, that's been a great record. I'm really proud of it. I never thought I would actually do an instrumental record.
It takes a lot of courage, man, to do that, I think. I was listening to it after I knew you, I was very proud of you because it's a very, you know, very difficult thing to do. And on your first go round to put a package together that and flawless would it's not the wrong, but that complete, it's a very rare thing, very special thing.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. Yeah. You know, I'll put it out there. I'm a pretty insecure guy. Like, I want people to like me. I want to be a likable person.
I like you, Charlie.
I want to be a helpful person. You know, I try not to be a jerk. You know, it's like one of my goals is to, you know, to be the guy in the band that nobody can complain about. And that's, you know, I'm still a musician, so that's probably inevitable, you know, strange breed of people. But, you know, with that record, I mean, you really put your soul out there. And instrumental music is not one of those things that is very popular nowadays. You know, not since the 60s and the 70s has instrumental music been really that big. I mean, you had the surfer music from the 60s, and then you had the progressive and jazz fusion stuff from the 70s. And so I knew that going into it. I knew it wasn't, I didn't want to get my hopes up and be like, oh, I'm going to be this or that. I'm going to be the next Joe Satriani or something. I didn't expect any of those things, but I really did. I wanted to get some respect from my peers, you know. And I've definitely gotten a lot of great feedback. I think one of the coolest feedbacks I got is Leroy. I wish we had like a ding, like every time his ding go off.
But, hey, if he's listening, he'll hear the ding every time you mention his name. Trust me.
That's right. That's right. I can see his smile now, Goofy Joker. He studied under Steve Smith.
Oh, wow.
From Germany.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And he sent one of the tunes to Steve, and Steve was, he sent some really nice comments back.
That's great.
And so that really meant a lot to me. You know, when you get heroes like that, but that's a big hero, but man, I'm surrounded by heroes every day. I mean, the musicians, the guitar players, bass players, drummers that are in my circle, you know, I have a lot of respect for. When they say, hey man, good job, you're like, all right, that's good, you know?
I want to talk about some of the songs, or later on I want to talk about some of the songs, but it's a great record, man. It's an incredible record, and it's the nice thing is too, it's yours. That's your style. You know, it's got you all over that. It's very identifiable as you're playing, your tone, your sound, your playing. And that's another thing you don't typically see first right out of the bat. You know, I didn't listen to that and say, oh, he sounds like this guy. It sounds like you, and it sounds great.
Well, thank you. Yeah. That's a hard thing to achieve too. And you're constantly telling yourself like, okay, you've got all these heroes and they're obviously going to, you know, make a little bit of presence there within your music. Mm-hmm. I think if you listen to the first song, it's obviously called Satch. Mm-hmm. It's actually, that's kind of a funny song if we can
talk about it a second.
My son's name is Satch.
Really?
Yes. And I named him after Joe Satriani and Satchmo, Louis mm-hmm. Armstrong.
Yeah.
This was a musical name. Well, you know, that's what we were telling everybody. You know, we named him after musical heroes. And someone said, oh, I thought you named him after Sarah and Charlie. You know,
there you go.
So I was that's like,
yeah, out of the box.
I can wrap it all up.
Man.
That song kind of has a Joe Satriani feel. That's what I was going for. And it's kind of just tipping the hat to Joe Satriani and to my son. And family's real important to me. So I kind of started the whole album out that way. So,
no, it's cool, man. Hey, so you said you grew up in Noonan?
Yeah, yeah.
Where is that?
Noonan is about 30-40 minutes south of Atlanta.
Okay.
And I was born and raised there. I have a lot of family there on my mom's side. A few of my dad's family's there too. But my home was still, the county's called Cayuta County. Mm-hmm. Not Cowita, but Cayuta County. And I grew up in a little place called Moreland, Georgia, which is right outside of Noonan. But Noonan's where you went to do everything. And Moreland, Georgia is home of Louis Grizzard, the famous comedian from back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my uncle, he went to school with Alan Jackson and Doug Stone and another one of my uncles, my dad's brother, he bought Doug Stone's house when Doug got famous and all that. So it was all this weird stuff. My grandfather worked on Alan Jackson's parents' heating and air. So it's just always been
there. Was it like eight people in that town?
At one time, you know, you could say that. Now it's pretty, big town now. It's much bigger. And I get to go home, you know, a couple times a year and visit friends and stuff and maybe get to play a show. And it's every time I go back, it's like, wow, you know, it's grown so much. But yeah, I'm from that little town of Noonan, Georgia.
Very cool, man. What was growing up like? What was your childhood like?
You know, I kind of took my childhood for granted. And I really didn't realize how good I had it. My parents bought a house that was on a lake.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I spent a lot of time fishing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had cousins that were going to concerts and doing all this fun stuff. And we weren't dirt poor or anything, but we weren't well off. Mm. You know, we didn't have a lot of money to just go. Basically fishing, go-karts. My dad was a pretty smart guy when it came to, you know, building stuff and fixing stuff. So he would, he worked for the housing authorities. So he would go pull out these old go-karts out of the back of dumpsters because people in the projects, once the oil went out in them, they thought they were broke, I guess.
Oh.
So he'd go dig them out, bring them home, fix them up, tweak them. And those things would go like 40, 50 miles an hour. And here we are racing up and down
on the road. On a go-kart? Holy smokes.
On a go-kart. I mean, he knew what he was doing with them, but I'm surprised I didn't get killed.
Yeah.
But yeah, we go-karts and fishing and being outside. I mean, that was life. And, you know, I was always jealous of my cousins because they were going to concerts and doing things. Now I look back on it, you know, I was an only child for 13 years, and those were some of the best years of my life, you know. So, yeah, man, it was cool, man. And I spent a lot of time with cousins. I didn't have a brother for 13 years. I have one brother, and his name is Bobby. And he came around when I was 13. And like I said, before that, it was all cousins playing, and had a couple cousins that played music and grew up playing music together and doing all that.
When did you know that you wanted to play guitar for a living?
When I was 5.
Get out.
Not for a living. I knew I wanted to play guitar when I was 5 years old. I give all that credit to my uncle, my mom's brother, Neil.
Man, you're giving the whole family, the whole town of Noonan a shout out here. That's awesome, man.
I know, Noonan, this is it right here. my uncle Neil was an interesting guy because he was one of those guys, kind of a jack of all trades, master of none guy too. He could paint, he could play a little guitar, he could build bikes. I mean, he was just one of those guys. And I remember on the weekends, I would go spend the night at his house. Now, he was the cool uncle. He took me to see Wayne's World. He took me to see Batman. You know, he had a couple of guitars and effects box and all this different stuff at his place. And he would let me stay up till 1, and we would watch Saturday Night Live together. And he would strap this signature Eric Clapton Stratocaster on me. And I would sit there in front of the TV watching G.E. Smith. So G.E. Smith is like my first visual guitar hero.
Oh, what a player he is.
Yeah, I mean, he's my guy. I hope I get to meet him someday. But I would sit there.
You and me both.
I would just beat on this guitar and, you know, stay up watching these skits that were totally inappropriate for my age, but I'm sure it went all over my head, you know. But yeah, I mean, he had that. I remember there was a Gibson custom Black Beauty. It had the gold hardware and everything. He still got these guitars, and I keep begging him to give them to me, but he's like, "Nah, you can buy them." I'm like, "I got no money." But I would love to have those guitars. They're really cool. But he was the influence, and my roots are in a couple different things. So my uncle was real big into British rock. So it was like Queen, Pink Floyd, you know, Eric Clapton, you know, anything Eric Clapton, Led Zeppelin, all those bands were really, really present, you know, during that age. And I was sitting there trying to figure it out. And, you know, I really couldn't play it that well or even attempt to when I was that age. It was being embedded in me. And so I had a mom and a grandfather that were in, my mom was into pop and country. My grandfather was into country. Every Saturday, Sunday night, it was Grand Ole Opry and Hee Haw. And I didn't realize how much that music meant to me till I got in my 20s. Like, I thought that I hated that music. Mm. You know, I just thought it was kind of cheesy when I was younger. And then when I got older, it's like, I made most of my living off of playing country. My dad was into rock and classical. So, you know, AC/DC, ZZ Top and the Cars, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, but my uncle was definitely the one that introduced me to the satanic instrument called guitar. And I never looked back, you know, it was always there and always present. And, just a, you know, took its toll on me. I actually played drums for a while too in middle school, you know, and guitar was always there. And I just never developed a true love for drums other than drummers. Like, I love drummers, man. Of course, Leroy, ding, there's another one. But yeah, guitar was definitely always there from about the age of five.
What made you move to Nashville?
That came from, so I started coming here in 2008, and I started coming with some friends that were friends with a pretty big songwriter, and I can't remember that songwriter's name to save my life. His name is Jim something, and he's written like a bunch of big hits, and we stayed at his house, you know, kind of got the bug. It's like, man, this place is so cool. Well, then a couple years later, Bad Horse, we got together.
Started this is making, your band in back in Georgia.
Yeah, back in Georgia. But it wasn't Bad Horse then. It was actually two guys that were just coming out as kind of songwriters. They were mm-hmm. kind of in the Brooks and Dunn thing.
Okay.
And they were really straight ahead country. Bad Horse is more of a Southern rock band. And I take all of the credit for the Southern rock thing. You know, those guys were like straight edge, and they slowly let me in to be a part of the band, and they introduced the songwriting to me, and said, I was like, yeah, man, you can't have all these slow songs. We got to rock it up a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
And then it slowly but surely became a band. We got signed to a label in 2010 called Global Maximus. It's no more. But we were just here a lot. I mean, we would spend 2 or 3 weeks here. The band didn't do as much touring once we signed. It was a really weird, weird time.
Wait a minute. You didn't do as much touring?
No.
What was the whole point of signing?
You know,
what did they want to do?
We all scratch our heads. We were in the studio. It was a really weird time because we show up to the studio in Atlanta to cut some songs, and Larry Blackman from Cameo is there. And he's producing a Southern rock record.
That's now, a little weird.
If you know who Larry Blackman is, he's the guy who will always be known as wearing the red cup mm-hmm. in Word Up video, right?
They're out of New York, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. And he's a super cool guy.
Yeah.
Super cool guy. And, man, I probably spent 6-8 months with that guy. I mean, we were just in and out of the studio, going back and forth to Nashville, coming back here. The record label, I think, was kind of a experiment. You know, they had their hands in a lot of different things. They were dealing with TV and record label and all this different stuff, and none of it made 100% sense, you know. They had us in the studio cutting records for other people that were part of the roster.
Oh, so you were like the house band sort of, yeah, the studio band?
Yeah, we were kind of the house band. There's actually some clips on YouTube of us cutting in the studio. There's a girl here in Nashville named Jessica Dong, a songwriter, and we cut like a single for her, and then there would be an R&B singer come in. And so we were cutting stuff for her out of the studio called Cupid Records here in Nashville. And it was cool, man. I wouldn't trade it for anything because I learned so much. Sure. About being in a studio, and I learned, you know, how to play within other genres and all that cool stuff. But it was just a really weird time. And the shows we did do, I think in the two years we were on the label, I think it wasn't even quite 2 years before the label kind of fell off. I think we might have done maybe 10 shows.
It was so, really weird.
It was really weird. I think I did more sessions than I did play any shows during that time. But prior to Bad Horse, when it was becoming Bad Horse, we did a lot of shows. I mean, we opened up for Neil McCoy, and we opened up for, Diamond Rio, and all these other country groups. You know,
who was booking those?
It was actually one of the head guys in the group, that guy, okay. Robert, I was telling you about. I mean, I always told that guy, I was like, man, you should just manage this band. Like, just get off the stage and manage, because he really had a knack for it. He knew how to pull strings, and he always tried to present us in a good way. And then when he handed the reins off, it just went, I don't want to talk down about anybody, but it just went really bizarre, and it was it was like being in a Twilight Zone for a couple of years there.
Man, I would be lying if I said this was the first story I heard about someone going to a label and the label screwing stuff up, or just like, you know, they got too much going on. They don't pay attention. You know, the sun was in their eyes. The you know, the dog ate the homework. You know, just all some form of excuse.
Lots of money was spent during that time. And you know, we were on retainer too. So I started recording. I had another project that never came out that was like a metal record. And me and the drummer, who were like big in the Dream Theater and all that kind of stuff at the time, we were going to the studio, and we didn't pay for the studio time either. So we were cutting this rock record because we had downtime. We had nothing else going on. And then we get a random call, 2 weeks, go to Nashville, record records, hang out, fine dine. I mean, I ate some of the best meals of my life during that time. But it was like, for what? The whole band like looks back and go, what the hell was that?
So it's just a lot of time wasting.
Yeah. A lot of time wasted. But I look back now and I go, I wouldn't trade it for the world, because I learned an awful lot about the music business and what not to do.
Yeah.
And then I learned a lot about studio time. Or, you know, spending time in the studio and working with different artists, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. It was definitely a learning experience.
But when did you move then? So at what point did you say you're going to move to Nashville permanently?
Yeah. So here I am living in hotels basically every 2 weeks for about a year and a half, 2 years. I mean,
that was a big stretch.
Yeah. I mean, I lived off of West End. And I can't remember the name of the hotel, and it's probably changed since.
You were single back then.
I was single back then, and I met my wife and came off the road for a short stint. But my wife and I have been married for 3 years, four, something like that. And I said, I was already working. I was starting to go back to Nashville, because I stopped going to Nashville right after I broke off from the label. And I just kind of got burnt out. It was one of those things. It was just a weird time, like I said. And but then I caught myself going back to Nashville, and here I am playing with different artists, constantly going back. And I was like, this is getting old. I was like, it's, you know, at that time it was a 5.5 hour trip.
That's a lot. I didn't realize it was that far.
With traffic, it can get to be about 5.5 hours, six.
Yeah. Cause you got to just come straight up 75, right?
Yep. Okay, 75, 24. Yeah. And so, you know, there was a lot of things going on back home, and I felt like I was hitting a brick wall, and music was just going to be it. You know, I mean, I was working a part-time job for my father-in-law when I lived in Macon. I was the only one bringing in really any income. My wife was bringing in income. She was a makeup artist and really good at it, and she brought in quite a bit of money doing that, but it was kind of part-time too. So it was just like, you know what, let's go for it, you know? And so 2015, I moved her and my son to Brentwood.
And, I know exactly where that is.
Paid out the Yahoo for an
apartment. I was going to say, that's probably a...
And here I am walking into it. Luckily, I had a lot of friends. I did work. I didn't work as much as I worked back home, though. It was weird. It's like when I moved here, I worked half as much. I was playing 130 to 150 shows a year.
Oh, you were gigging right away.
Yeah. When I came here, it cut like almost in half.
Okay.
It was so bizarre. Some of the bands I were playing with, they decided they wanted to keep somebody in Georgia so they could rehearse with them. So I lost a few gigs that way. But it worked out. My wife, she got a job, and she honestly, if it wouldn't have been for her, we wouldn't have survived. I mean, she really kept the boat afloat. And I owe her everything for that. She allowed me to continue on with my career. And it got real rocky there for a minute. Financially and everything. And here you are paying out $1,600 a month for a two bedroom apartment
in Brentwood. Yeah. That's priceless.
Yeah. Brentwood. And then we got really lucky about a year later and we found our house here in Walter Hill. Mm. And it's an old, almost 100-year-old farmhouse.
That's great, man.
You're going to have to work on it. You're going to have to fix it up. So I took 2 months off and, from doing music and basically got in here with my own two hands and started fixing the house up. Then it almost burnt down. No relation to me. I didn't have anything to do with it. It was old wiring in the house, burned up our fireplace. We lived in a hotel for about two Holy months.
Smokes, you guys are lucky.
Dude, it was crazy. And then we moved back in. The fire happened in October, about 2 months after we bought the house. I came off from doing a show, did an opener with Luke Combs. With a guy I play with named Justin Dukes. He's a Nashville songwriter and artist here. And came home that day. I started ripping out a tub. And thanks to my father-in-law and my dad, they both came up and helped with the house.
Oh, that's cool.
A couple of weeks here and there. And then we hired out on some flooring and stuff like that. But for the most part, I was here every day, even after we were basically kicked out of the house and we had to live in a hotel for till January. I looked at it as an opportunity to make sure the house was ready. So when we moved in, the house was done. I mean, I did the painting and caulking and hammering and everything had to be done. And then since then, man, just been hitting it hard, promoting myself and putting myself out there. And I play with several different acts. I just got hooked up with a corporate band, which is, you know, definitely helped quite a bit, but they're still artists.
And you're doing corporate gigs on the weekends?
Yeah, on the weekends. Occasionally there'll be, you know, something during the week. But I'm teaching. I teach from my home. I have my own studio, which you can kind of see here in the backdrop. But yeah. So teaching and during the week and then random sporadic session work. You know, I wished it was more, you know, of course.
Do you think it would be more if you were in town? Or you just got to get more. You got to get a little more known.
You got to get known. Yeah, yeah. This is a 10-year town.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where I put myself out there all the time and I'm like, hey, I'm available for sessions. And I get a lot of stuff from old clients.
Yeah.
And then from back home. And then I'll get stuff from airgigs.com.
Yeah.
Which is a nightmare. Because if you go on there and you look for a guitar player, it's like a flood of great guitar players.
And it's probably really inexpensive. Because nobody knows how to differentiate themselves. So they differentiate themselves by being the cheapest guy in town.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. I mean, my thing that I put out there is originality. You know, I try to promote myself from an original player versus a copycat.
Yeah.
I mean, not to say that I don't copycat. I can do that too. But I want to have my DNA on anything I do.
Sure.
Because it's like, I think you know this, you've had these conversations. If you want Brent Mason, go get Brent Mason.
Yeah.
If you want these guys, go get those guys. You know, if you want a copycat guy, I mean, there's guys that can do a really half-assed job of that, but I want to try my best to put my name on something if I can and be tasteful about it, you know?
So I appreciate you sharing all this stuff. You're doing all the things that you got to do to make a living in music today. You're doing licensing as it comes up. You got some sessions. You got teaching. You got weekend gigs. You got a corporate gig. And then you're getting your work, putting your album together. It's a full plate, man.
It is. And I wished it paid more.
Yeah.
Right. I tell everybody, you know, people say, hey, man, I'm thinking about moving to Nashville. And I say, don't. Only because you can't just move here and do this for a living. Like, you have to have so many different avenues. I mean, there's young guys out there and girls that I get calls from family members and stuff like, you know, John Doe wants to move to Nashville and make it as a songwriter. Well, he better have a job.
Yeah.
He better, you know, find him some roommates. He better be willing to live off of romaine noodles and eggs.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you don't come to this town and make money. You know, it's a long journey. And I'm still on it.
Yeah. And I think it's like that in anything, though. I think the overnight success myth is just that, a myth, whether you're going to be an athlete or an entertainer or a musician or, you know, open a business. It generally doesn't happen overnight, man. It happens over time.
Well, I heard a saying that has rang true to me very much so. And it's, life is a journey, not a destination. Music is a journey, not a destination. Because as soon as something great comes along, you can't live off of that moment.
Right.
You got to keep struggling for the next moment and striving for the next moment, because it comes and goes. I mean, I've had some really cool things happen in my life, career, whatever you want to call it, but. If I just sat here and lived off of that, I'd be that old guy's like, I remember when I did this and that. No, I want to be that old guy's like, I got to get to the next thing.
Anyway, yeah.
You know? So you can't come here expect nothing. Yeah. That's really the nature of this beast, is nobody owes you anything. There's so much music. These songwriters that I work with from time to time, they think their songs are great, and they may well be, but that doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter. I mean, there's like hundreds of guitar players in this town that could run circles around me speed wise.
Well, that's another thing. I don't think people realize the talent that's there. So if you're going to come, you better, number one, you've got to have talent.
Yeah.
Like a lot of it.
And you gotta have charisma. You got to have just willing to put up with all the BS that comes, well, like you said, with anything in life. I mean, you really got to have thick skin. You know, don't come here. Like, I see a lot of these guys. I will say I do struggle a little bit with, you know, you got a lot of kids that come here and their parents are kind of paying their way.
Yeah.
And it is frustrating because you know what? If I was that person, good on me, man.
Yeah.
Good on him. You know, it's hard because it's hard to see those things. But at the same token, it's like, if I was in their shoes, man, I'd eat it up too.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of kids that are born into the business here. And they're good. It's not that they're not good. It is hard as a guy who's been struggling. I'm 35. I've been in the music business now for 12, 15 years. And I see those guys that are just kind of walking into a situation. Life has been handed to them. They've got the opportunities waiting on them. And I may not have those same opportunities, but I have to be empathetic to it and go, if I was that person, man, good on me.
Yeah,
good on
absolutely.
Me.
Yeah.
You know, you can't get distracted. And I'll admit, I'd be a liar if I said it didn't distract me. And you just have to, like, if you're going to move here, you got to get through that mental game, man. You got to, and I'm very thankful I have a wife and a son, you know, that encourage me, and family members that encourage me and don't pick on the process. They just go, you got this, just keep one foot in front of the other. Your time will come.
Yeah. It's very hard to, if you're a driven person, it's hard to detach yourself from the results of what you're doing. And if you're killing yourself and those results aren't what you are, that the reality is it's just not a good feeling. And you've really got to dig deep to hang in there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you had a conversation with, John from Kenny Chesney's.
John Conley.
John Conley about mental health.
Yeah, yeah.
That, I mean, I love that conversation you guys had, because it's true, man. It's this realm is, you get beat up every day, you know, to look at another guy that maybe that player's not that great, or that singer's not that great, or their song's not that great. Hmm. And you look at that person, you're like, man, they got it. Or maybe that person got the gig or got the song on the radio because they're far better looking than you. You know, it can be as shallow as that.
Absolutely. You know, I can't tell you how many guys I've interviewed. They say, you know, people hear with their eyes.
That's right. I'm glad we're doing this by audio. Nobody would watch me.
Hey, me neither.
So, you know, but it's true. It is mental health is a big thing within the music industry, and I'm glad that it's been brought up a few times. When you told me you want to interview me, and I really appreciate it, I wanted to bring it up one more time just to say, you know, these guys listening, man, you need to realize that mental health is a real thing, and you need to realize that life promises you nothing. And when you're surrounded by talent and you're surrounded by non-talent and all these different things, you've really got to sift through all this mess. And if you got to seek some help, you got to talk to somebody, because this industry will wear you out. One minute you're hot, next minute you're not. I mean, look at all the artists that have come and gone. I don't care if you're talking from the 60s to the modern day. I mean, CC DeVille, and I'm not even really a Poison fan, but I remember watching him. He had a really bad coke habit. He gained like 200 pounds or something like that, 100 pounds. He got pretty huge. You know, he got depressed. I remember watching him on VH1, and I was like, dude, this guy had it all. You know, and he went through this whole depression thing. Here's a rock star, you know, a rock god, quotation marks. And here he is going through it. So the guys like me who are maybe on the lower end of the spectrum versus the guys that are way up top, they're going through the same stuff, man. Yeah. It's all mental. And, man, you and I have talked about this briefly, but I'm a believer. Christ is my Savior. I don't mind putting that out there. And, you know, I seek spiritual help, man. I really do. I do a lot of praying. I do a lot of seeking first every day. And it keeps me humble, keeps me grounded, and keeps me moving forward. It keeps me from going nuts.
I think it goes back to what you opened this interview with, is my mom told me something when I was little, and she said, don't be afraid to ask for help. I think that is a pretty important universal rule to carry or to use in throughout whatever you're doing. You got to have help. I mean, I know I couldn't get through shit without my wife. So, I mean,
you and me both,
and buddies of mine, you know, so it's, you know, everybody has stuff going on at some point in time, and definitely you need some assistance.
Ask for help. It's do it. Don't wait till it's too late. Always be willing to ask for encouragement. You know, this life is hard, man. I mean, it's not an easy task.
Life is not for the weak, is what I would say.
I don't care if you're what religion you are or what you're into, whatever your spiritual thing is, or maybe not. If it's self-help books, I don't care what it is. There's no like instructional manual for every little situation to go, this will fix everything right here. You know, it's piece by piece. I mean, things that have happened in my 20s versus in my 30s, I have to take it from a whole new light every time, you know? So yeah, not to go too down, you know, a bunny trail, just, you know, it's not an easy gig, man. Life is not an easy gig. Don't be afraid to ask for help.
Absolutely, man. Hey, let's talk about gear for a few minutes. I see your guitars over there. You got them all lined up. I think I know what your answer is going to be, but what's your go-to guitar, and what other two would round out your top three?
Definitely the PRS. It's the David Grissom model.
Yeah, I figured. You know what? I just got off the phone with them, and I asked them, I said, we were talking about Grissom, about his episode, particularly on this show, my interview with him. And I said, is that the most popular model? Because that's the model that I hear most often. And she said, actually, no, which I was surprised. And she said the Custom 24, the McCarty 594, and the new John Mayer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, is tearing it up. But the Custom 24 and the McCarty 594 are the most popular.
I used to tour with a Custom 24, and I never could connect with it. it to me, it just sounded stale. Like it just, I don't know. There was something about it just didn't do what I wanted to do. But that David Grissom, man, I tag him. I'm sure he gets tired of all this guitar on Instagram because it's like, thank you for this guitar. I mean, it really is. It's awesome. It's a great guitar.
So the Custom 24, I have never played a PRS, believe it or not. Is that an actual custom guitar, or is it just called a Custom 24?
I guess it's like a custom shop, and it's got 24 frets on it. Because okay. You can get a Custom 22 as well, which is, you know, more like a Gibson or whatever. But yeah, I never was crazy about the pickups. It played well. It definitely played well. But it was a borrowed guitar, and I used it for that whole time I was in Bad Horse. There was a Sunburst. A friend of mine had it. It's kind of funny. Like, most of the guitars I used during that time were all borrowed. Because, man, I was, like I said, I didn't come from money. I watched these guys that come into town, man, and they've got, like, truckloads of gear, like custom shops and all these cool amps. Man, when I came to town, I had a Fender Hot Rod 112 Deluxe. And I think I paid $350 for it. I had a Ibanez RG cheap model, like $300 guitar. I had a delay pedal, which I think was the DD4, the Line 6 DD4. Had a couple overdrive box, and that's all I had. This guitar right here.
Let me see your Grissom, if it's handy.
Oh, sure.
If you don't mind, because I want to look at it. Okay, so it's. So it's got the two humbuckers.
Yeah. It's got the bird inlays.
Yeah.
Well, let me see if I can get the camera right.
Yeah, you got it. I see it.
And the headstock. It's got the tuning, the locking tuning. You know, the PRS has their own locking system, and I really like it. It's pretty good. This white Strat here is kind of a interesting story. One of the guys in the band had this guitar. And he was more of an acoustic guy, and he bought it. It's a 2004. It's the 50th anniversary of Fender Strats. He had it and never played it. And I was like, man, I want to use that on some records and stuff. So
is that ebony neck?
Yes.
Yeah. I thought I couldn't sell it. I thought so. And, so just let me describe it. It's like an Olympic white with an ebony neck and a black pickguard.
No, that's a tortoiseshell.
Oh, it's tortoiseshell. Okay, I can see it with the light here.
It's got Michael Landau pickups in it.
Okay.
And then it's got locking tuners. But when I got it, I mean, it was completely stock. And an interesting thing about those guitars from the 50th anniversary is if you get them, the cavity's already routed out for a humbucker. They were kind of... I'll just say it. They're like bastard guitars because what they were is, from what I understand, what I was told by Luthier, is they took the guitars from that year, the Fender Strats that they made, and they just threw them all together and just made this guitar. So it's just kind of like a Frankenstein for Fender.
But it's got a nice ebony neck, though.
Oh, it's one of my favorite guitars. It's been with me for a long time. But when I got that guitar initially, I was just borrowing it, and I kept offering the guy, like, I think he paid $1,200 for it. And I was like, man, I really want this guitar. He's like, no, I'm not selling it. When I left the band, came back a year later for a one-off with the band. And I went down in the basement to rehearse, and there was that guitar exactly where I left it. Not been touched at all.
Oh, my God.
Pulled it out. It had rust all over all the stuff. I mean, it was just in bad shape. And I was like, dude, I give you $500 for it. And I don't know if he said, okay, fine. I gave him $500, took it back home, fixed it up, threw in new pickups. It did have a white pick guard. I think I had a pearl pick guard on it one time. It's kind of like my David Gilmour Black Strat.
Yeah.
It had several different things in it, but yeah, it's that go-to, man. It's got that great sound. Those pickups that Michael Landau put out with Sir, man, they're really great. I really like them.
What? How are those pickups different from a regular Strat pickup? And who made? Oh, they're Sir, you said. Okay,
they're Sir. Yeah, I'll describe them the way that I hear them. Basically, it's a little bit fatter of a Strat tone. That's really what it is for me. It's like it's got that nice chimey thing, but it's a little rounder. Mm-hmm. So it still cuts through. The mids are great, but it's just it's almost like you're listening to a Strat through studio speakers.
Okay.
You know, so it's not just harsh, you know, like the Texas Specials or whatever. They kind of have that little
Those are hard. I have the on that white one, I have the Noiseless.
Yeah.
They're great. And on the black one, they have the Fat 50s, and I really like them. I've tried the Texas Specials. I did not like them. I thought they were a little rough, whatever, harsh. I think you said it was a good word. They didn't sound as good as.
And I'm sure that I'm describing these pickups very poorly. I would say go Google Pete Thorne or something, and I'm sure he'll give you one of those guys will tell you exactly what it sounds like. But to me, it sounds like listening to like the best Strat tone through a great set of monitor speakers. I mean, they're just great. I mean, every selector switch you get on, I mean, you get that Vince Gill, you know, second position, or you get that middle tone, like out of phase, like Stevie Ray, you know, or the neck, which everybody loves, you know. I mean, that's kind of the secret sauce there. But yeah, and then my third guitar would be this Telecaster here.
Is that relic or is that?
It's relic.
Yeah, they did a good job on that, man.
Well, not really. And I hope if they hear me on here, they'll probably hate me for it, but it looks really cool in pictures. And I needed a Telecaster. I have like a artist endorsement thing with David Allen, so I put some of their hot Tele pickups in here. Mm-hmm. And then just upgraded Callahan Bridge and stuff like that. But the deal is with this thing is it was on reverb.com. It's by a company called Relic Guitars. And I think that they hadn't been out that long.
Okay.
I saw this on Reverb and the pictures had like, it was laying over a leather couch and all this different stuff. It looked like just really cool looking in pictures. I was like, you know, I need a good telly. And this was a few years back. And I'd like to have something when I'm doing shows. And man, this thing spanks most tellies that I listen to. It's a $400 guitar with about $500 worth of upgrades in it. And I'll never get rid of it. Nobody would want to buy this guitar unless they just really love the sound, which has got a great sound. It plays great, but it's nothing special. You know, it's just, it's like you could probably go buy a Mexi Tele. Hmm. The right pickup and have a similar guitar. I mean,
gotcha.
It's a road horse. I loved it because I didn't have to worry about messing it up.
Yeah.
So,
you know, there's so many companies that make Strats now that they just like, you know, you got G&L, you got LSL. I saw a guy yesterday playing a Schecter Strat. Man, it looked great. It sounded amazing, man.
Yeah.
There's just so many great guitars out there. So many guitars, so little time, you know.
Yeah.
it's just sure. Like, and I'm not I've got more guitars than I need. I'd like to, it's funny you mentioned that. I have a Les Paul Classic. I've had it a little while and I just don't bond enough with it. I kind of want to get like maybe like a jazz box or something, but I have the 335. So I'm like, you know, what the hell?
Yeah. See, my next two guitars is a 335 and then I need an SG, you know, I need those two.
Let me tell you, this is what I'm playing now. And I love it. My SG.
Is that the $599 special?
No, it's a 2013 guitar. And that year they released it. It's a 61.
Oh, the reissue.
It's not a custom, nothing like that. It's just a standard, just a regular SG. But I'm not a big guy. As you saw me, I'm not a big guy. I'm 5'9". My hands are average size. And this neck it's just phenomenal. It's for me, and I love it. It's got the classic 57s, which I absolutely love. Same thing is on my 335, it's classic 57s. And, man, I wind up playing this more often than not. The Strat is a little easier than this for some reason. Well, I like my Strats because they have the bar.
Sure.
You know? Yeah. And man, it's nothing easier to play than a Strat, I don't think, for me.
Yeah.
But I love, you know, the humbucker sound, and these pickups are just great. And I just wish, like everybody else, you know, the SG is a little weird because of the way.
Top heavy, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm, yeah, you know, I'm getting used to it. I just love this guitar, and it's just so accessible.
Yeah.
You know, the neck is so great. And
well, I need an SG for slide. I mean, that's really, I could get away with anything. It's just, you know, you think Derek Trucks, you think, God, you got to have an SG. So I really want that to get the height and all that. I don't play any open tunings because anytime I have to play a song, I've got to jump to another song. So I don't have time to change guitar. So I've basically learned how to play without open tuning, you know, but I would really like to have an SG in the studio just so I can go to it. I normally tune a guitar and do all my slide work that way. But, I get it, man. I love it.
I need to put some of my guitars up on my, I need to just make an announcement and say, I got these three guitars for sale on my website, and then someone could, you know, I'll trade or whatever, you know.
I didn't connect with my Les Paul either. That's another reason. Yeah, I sold it for the record, but I just never. But I do miss that town, especially in the studio. It has that sound.
It's a Les Paul, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and when you're playing rock, man, there's no better sound. But
absolutely.
Other than that, the PRS for me though, live, I mean, I can go from playing any funk tune to playing Van Halen. Like, I mean.
But how does that okay, so when you're playing, how is that neck? Like, to me, the Strat and that, not as flat as the SG, the Strat necks are slim and that SG is really slim. And for me, I've come to realize I just like a slimmer neck. How is that Griffin PRS?
It's a little thicker than my Strat. Mm-hmm. The Strat's definitely skinnier. It's a little bit thicker. But it plays, man. Like, everybody that picks it up, like, I've had telly players that pick it up, play through my rig, and they're like, they would play that over their telly. You know, they play it over their Strat. Because the thing is, it's got the push-pull, so you can get that single coil sound. I mean, it's...
And it's a legit push-pull. I mean, you can hear the single coil. Because I had nothing against Tom Anderson guitars. You know, this just wasn't my thing. I had an Anderson one time, and it split. It was the Bulldog, the one they got the cease and desist for. And yeah, it played great, but man, the pickups I thought were horrible, man.
Just didn't do it for you.
No, and when you pulled it, I didn't see any real difference, man. It was just nothing about it. Just the feel of it was great, but everybody said, well, you could have put different pickups in there, man. I'm not that guy that I'm gonna.
Well, I've kind of figured out because I have to play so many different styles, not just in a corporate band, but with different artists and different sounds, you know, I kind of have pedals set up to do different things. So like I use the Cali 76 in a boost. And if I've got that Strat sound pulled up on the PRS, I mean, I can get that chink sound, that chink, 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 you know, funky sound, but then I can push it in and turn on, you know, a nice distortion pedal and I can play Van Halen if I want.
That's really cool.
So yeah, I mean, I can get any tone I want from that, and then pedals, and then I use a Cerebella. You can't see it in the video. Just a 112. I can stick that in the corner of a room, and you'd think I've got a plexi back there and all that. That's man, cool. It's just a palette. So
very cool, man. Desert Island Discs, man. No particular order. Top three.
Knee Jerk Reaction, right?
Correct. Man, I'm repeating myself so much. Everybody knows my words. I got to get some new lines.
I would say, no, it's good, man. It's good.
Get some lines.
I would probably say, gosh, it's such a hard one because I go through so many genres of things that I love. And I don't really listen to a lot of vocal songs much anymore unless I'm learning. I'll go with stuff that makes me feel good.
Yeah.
I would say... Steve Winwood, High Life, Back in the High Life Again record.
I saw him in concert a while back.
Yeah.
He put on a great show. He's a hell of a guitar player, actually.
Yeah, yeah. He'd play anything, man. I saw him with Tom Petty probably 6 years, 7, 8 years ago. He just amazing. probably Steve Winwood's Back in the High Life Again record. Let's see. The record, all right, then a record from my childhood that meant a lot to me would probably be Randy Rhoads' tribute album, the live recording.
Mm-hmm.
I studied that thing inside and out. Love that record. And then I'd have to say Pink Floyd, Animals. Gosh, it's like I'm sitting here thinking, I'm like, well, Eric Johnson, I mean, you got the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles, I wouldn't even start it with music if it wasn't for the Beatles. You know, I learned everything about chords and harmony just as a kid learning the Beatles.
What made you pick Animals over Dark Side or Wish You Were Here? I love all three.
Animals is, it's kind of like their darkest album, and I'm a really big fan of dark albums.
Fair Warning's
the same thing. Like Fair Warning's my favorite Van Halen record. You know, it's just, there's just something that was twisted in those Joker's minds then, man. I mean, Animals was when Roger went off the deep end, you know, and spit in the face of the fan. And I'm a big fan of the whole catalog of Floyd. I'll tell you a quick story. When I was about 13, you know, disc had been out forever now, since the 80s. 13 years old, my dad asked me what I want for my birthday. I said, man, I want a CD player. I want the new Weezer Blue CD. I want No Doubt, Tragic Kingdom. I love both those records. Great records. Obviously did then too. Birthday comes around. There's no CD player. There's no CDs. He walks in with an 8-track player and a box of 8-tracks.
Okay.
Sets them in front of me, says, happy birthday. And I was like, what is this? This is
yes.
And he starts pulling them out. He's like,
and we got you a pet dinosaur.
Yeah. I mean, I was just so confused. And he starts pulling out. I mean, I've got like this collection of the greatest. I mean, he still got it at his house. I want to get them back because when I moved out when I was 19, I just couldn't carry them with me. But man, I had everything from Merle Haggard to Aretha Franklin to Van Halen to Pink Floyd to Elton John. I mean, you name any classic figure, I had it right there. And in that moment, I took it for granted. I was like, this is crap. You know, this is old stuff. But man, I spent, in my teens, I spent so much time listening to these records all the way through because you couldn't, you know, you could punch a button and you could go somewhere in the middle of an 8-track. It wasn't like you could just fast forward it or rewind it or punch the next song. You had to just go with whatever came up. So I would listen to the records or the 8-tracks from beginning to end. And so at one time I could play you know, Dark Side, Wish You Were Here, Animals, and The Wall. I could play all four of those records from beginning to end. That was like, David Gilmour was my guy.
Yeah, he's my guy too.
Yeah, I mean, he's my biggest influence ever, you know. And we've talked about that in extent. I mean, we love him a lot, but a lot of those songs, I mean, the Allman Brothers, I had all those early Allman Brothers. And I had tapes too. I had tapes. I didn't get a CD player till much later. But yeah, man, that was my bag, man. Lots of Floyd. David's my guy.
Hey, let's talk about for a few minutes your record, your last LP, Tall Tales. It's got 8 instrumental tracks. You got a couple of amazing players to guest on 2 of the tracks.
Sorry.
Bless you. Alan Hines and Mark Letary. Pick one of them and talk about how you wound up hooking up with them.
I'll talk Alan because that was kind of interesting. So I was out in California for the first time, out in L.A., and this was the year before, probably about 2 years before the record release.
What were you doing? You out there for the first time?
I was out in L.A. for the first time.
What were you doing there?
My family was out there. My wife was on my wife and my father-in-law were on a show called The Biggest Loser.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah. And so we all went out there for the finale and I was like, man, I'm going to see if Alan's around. So I sent him an email like, man, I got to get a lesson. And I'm self-taught, you know, I've been influenced by musicians.
Wow. You're, You're completely self-taught.
Yeah, I didn't take any formal lessons. I just read a lot of books.
Holy crap, man. I cannot imagine playing at your level all on you. That I did not know that. That's even more impressive, man.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, I was always told, you know, hang around older people. They'll teach you everything you need to know. And that's what I did. I mean, I never had any real set – no real set down moments, but just hung out with the right people. Leroy Ding, a big mentor, man. I learned a lot from him. Guys on my record, man, I pick their brains all the time, and I correct anything that I didn't know. And I still do that. If I have questions about my theory and where I'm at, I'll just call a buddy and be like, am I on the right track with this? Cause you know, I wasn't a YouTube kid. That came out much later.
Yeah.
But, back to Alan. So I'm out there, and it's kind of a funny story. If you look up a song from his Fly South record that I think it's called Joni or something like that, and it was written for Joni. He released it early on YouTube, and it was just the music, and he's like walking around in his yard with a camera, and you know, you kind of see where he's at. So when we pull up to where he lives, I noticed the bridge in this video. I'm like, okay, we're definitely here. There's this huge house, this mansion, I guess. We're in the hills, and I'm looking around. There's this guy, this heavyset guy, on the up in the what you call it, the balcony there. He's stretching out. He's got his shirt off, and I'm like, Alan's overweight, you know. And I pull up, and I kind of look. I definitely didn't know where I was. I thought I did. And I said, hey, man, I'm looking for Alan. Oh, man, he lives over there. And, you know, he's got his bungalow over there. So I go knock on the door. There's Alan. And, like, all the videos I've watched of him in his place, there it is before me. And it's just covered in guitars and amps and everything. And when you did your interview, I'm sure you saw how it was set up.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, man, come in, you know. And so for like the first hour, I got to listen to Fly South before Vinny Caliuta even played on the record.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
He's like, yeah, man. He was like really excited. He's like, you want to check this one out? And it was $100 for an hour. I was like, yeah, sure. And he's like, all right, it's your money. I was like, oh, did I just like waste all this time listening to a record? But that wasn't the case. He was really cool. We spent about 2.5 hours together.
Oh, that's great.
And played through guitars. He was like, man, check this guitar out. Tell me what you think about this, because he's always flipping gear, guitars and stuff. Well, then we go into a lesson, and we're talking about melodic minor scale and different ways to use it. And, you know, I'm just kind of picking his brain. I'm playing for him. We're kind of jamming together, you know, going through licks. He's a strong legato player in his own way, and I'm not that kind of player. And we have a really good time together, really super nice. While we're talking, Robin Ford pings in and oh, this is Robin. I'm like, I'll tell him I love him, you know. he's my favorite blues guy by far. But so I get ready to leave, and he comes out. My in-laws come to pick me up. I feel like a kid. Like, it was weird. Like, here I am, 30-something-year-old man, and I've got parents picking me up. And
yeah, yeah.
Alan comes out. He's like, yeah, your son-in-law is great. He said, he's like, Charlie, do you have any original music? And I said, no. He's like, you need to record something, dude. He's like, you really need to put something together. And I said, Alan, if I do, you know, can I hit you up? And he's like, and maybe get you to play. He's like, yeah, sure. So just that little encouragement that he saw something in me and
felt
necessary to tell me that I needed to do this. That's the reason he plays on the track Aha. And it's basically kind of my own little inside joke. It's like saying Alan Hines, ha, I got him.
You know?
You don't, I do. And, I called him up, I actually emailed him, and he sent me over like 4 different takes that were amazing, and put his little part. And I wrote that song. I listened to a lot of his material, and I tried to pull elements from his music into that song. And he takes the middle section solo of Aha, and then I take the back end and then everything around the middle. So, but yeah, that was really cool. Hit him up a year and a half later, and he's was more than happy to. So
that's great, man. That's a nice story, and it's nice that he inspired you to make that record.
Yeah, there's been a few guys like that. I did a show with Kansas, opened up for them, and what's his name? With the patch. The original guitar player.
I know who you're talking about. I don't know his name.
Kansas, yeah, I met him backstage. He was another one of those guys that said, "You're a killer guitar player. Don't ever quit."
That's really cool, man.
Yeah, and when you get into that mental illness of being a human, you know, and you take those moments in your life and you try to remember them, you know. They keep you going. So always encourage somebody because you never know what they're going to.
Yeah. You don't know what someone's going through at any given point in time either, man.
Yeah. So those moments I really treasure when you have heroes that will give you that encouragement. So heroes out there, make sure you encourage the little guys because, you know, they need it.
and let me tell you, everybody's a little guy.
Absolutely.
Because everybody needs, you know, people think sometimes that, oh, so-and-so is X, Y, or Z. They don't need, everybody's human. That's what I've learned.
Absolutely.
So just to let everybody know, all the listeners, the record I'm talking about is Charlie Gilbert, Tall Tales. It's an 8-song instrumental. For me, you know, like I always rate my songs on iTunes. 5 of the songs were 5 stars and the other 3 were 4 songs. If you're a guitar player, you will love the record. It's got beautiful melodies, great guitar licks. It's just a very beautiful record. 8 instrumentals, 46 minutes, you know, so the average length of the song is 6 minutes long, which is great. You even have one song that's 7 minutes long, which is the amazing closing track called Grease Fire. I want to talk about 2 tracks. I could easily talk about a bunch of them, but the 7th track, I always say the numbers now because people don't pay attention to names anymore. And you know, it's like,
yeah,
I got to push number 7. I always bought music, and I recently started, I bought Apple Music.
Yeah, I did that as well.
I got to tell you, man, it's like discovering sex for the first time.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry. I know your family's going to be listening to this. I apologize.
No, but, they won't at some point too. It's all good.
Yeah. I hope so.
It's getting awkward now.
But, it's like, it's the world of music literally at your fingertips. I mean, you know,
scary.
It's just really scary. It's amazing. Yeah. But the track Tall Tales, which is the title track, the guitar work in there is really awesome. And every time I listen to that track, I actually get goosebumps.
Thank you. You
did a really good job in there, like taking, you know, building up the climax and then pulling it back. And again, your drummer, you guys have an amazing groove going. I just had a few questions about the track. So Tall Tales, what made you name the album off that track, or was it the other way around?
So it had a running name for the longest time, and I can't remember what it was called. But I was riding down the road listening to the tracks before I named that song, and my wife was there. She actually named the song, and she's like, it just feels like you're telling this big elaborate story, you know, and she said, why don't you call it Tall Tales? And I said, that's really cool.
That's a cool name. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's, you know, put it together as like, it was a big story. And she said, and the rest of the record feels like this great big story, 'cause you're just telling so much information. And I said, well, I'll just name the record that, you know? And so that's really how that came to be.
Very cool, man. Thank you for telling me that. And you know what? You did a good job, which I know there's no formula for this. It's like part science, part, you know, gut feel, part art of putting the record together.
Yeah.
It's like putting a very complicated, you know, there's 8 songs, but it's a very complicated jigsaw puzzle. You know, I can't imagine how many times in a row you had to listen to the full song lead into the next one, and yeah, that works. No, that doesn't. Let's back it up. Now you got to re-listen. So I know that's a lot of work. You did a great job with it.
That is a headache.
Yeah. What did you play on that song, guitar and amp wise? If you remember,
I definitely use. So when I record rhythm, I usually will use any of the guitars that I have. I try to do 3 or 4 different rhythm tracks, different pickup styles you know, for the mixing engineer. And then, of course, I had acoustics. I think I use my Larravee on that one. And then I'll use any cheap acoustic. Like, acoustic instruments are really interesting because you can and you can have the most expensive acoustic in the world, and you can play it on stage, and great, have you. Maybe you're just playing a single instrument. But if you notice in Tall Tales, there's a lot of acoustic layering. I use my Larravee. I used a lower-end Breedlove. And then I have a couple of old Silvertone acoustics.
I didn't even know they made acoustics.
Yeah, yeah, I've got one. You can't see it here. It's off to the right there, hanging from the 50s. And then I've got a couple of other ones laying around. And so I'll just put that in there for layering purposes. And it may not poke out as much, but it really helps a lot. So I'll use any acoustic instrument. It can be a kid's toy. If it stays in tune, I'll use it. So I use that for the main instrumental. It was more than likely the PRS. The reason I put the PRS on the record is because I used it more than any of the rest of the guitars. Yeah. But yeah, the Strat's probably in there on the clean stuff. I mean, you know, and then the effects and, of course, different amplifiers and stuff.
Great, beautiful song, man. And then this song, which is, I guess, my favorite, which was the closing track called Grease Fire. Talk about telling a story. I thought that was like a trip, not just through space and time, but also through drums and guitar. You that was really a voyage in that one, man. Really hard to put together. You had everything. You had some like spacey rock in there. You had some wah stuff going on. Great melody lines. This was the thing that impressed me. You had the melody lines that came back and tie everything together. And as a new songwriter, or at least as a new song of recording your songs for the first time,
yeah,
that's not always easy to do. You know, yeah, I thought you did
I'm really impressed that you recognize that in the song. Cause this was like, this last song was supposed to be the song that was supposed to be an accident. Okay. Like a car. Okay. Although it had that consistent melody to it, it was also going to have all this car accidents around it.
Right.
And because I wanted a song, because this record would be really hard to pull off live, and I've yet to be able to play this song, any of these songs live. But this was one of those where I wanted to be able to improvise without, I have a simple melody and then everything else around it is whatever happens, happens. You know, so to have, because there's kind of two sections. You have the kind of the meat of the song, and then it goes into this like really
Very, yeah. It's a total journey, man.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it that song was really, for the most part, complete accident. I did have the melody, but it was kind of written on the spot. It wasn't really something that planned out. It's just like, that works, you know. It served its purpose. I could have made something else for it, and it wouldn't have mattered to me. I didn't really care. That song is probably, I probably put the least amount of effort into that song than any of the rest.
It's amazing. My favorite song. There is so much going on in there, man. I thought it was just brilliant. In fact, I would tell anybody, if you got time to just listen to one track, listen to Tall Tales, listen to the last track, Grease Fire, man. It's like, again, if you are a guitar player, it would be like pretty impossible not to like that song. There's just so much going on there to like. It was really good. Really good job. I thought it was very difficult to pull something like that off.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
All right. So, tough question. What do you like most about yourself, Charlie? And thank you for making that record, man. And thank you for handing it to me that time. It was so funny.
Thank you for listening, man.
I'm sorry it took so long.
Well, I don't, like I said, don't expect anything. That's probably one of the hardest lessons I've had to learn is not to expect. So it's one of those things where I admire what you do. Your show is great, man. It's definitely passed a lot of road time for me. So to me, it was just like, hey, you know, if he gets a chance, great. If not, no hard feelings. But What do I like most about myself?
It's a tough question.
It is a tough question, man. That I think the biggest thing is that I'm not a quitter. I think that's probably what I like most about myself is I no matter how hard it gets, no matter how deep of a hole I might even get myself in, I don't quit. You know, that's probably the biggest thing.
You seem like an extremely loyal person as well.
I try to be.
Yeah. Flip side, man, if you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?
I would probably, there's a few bad habits like biting my fingernails. Definitely quit that. I wish that I would not get so emotionally attached to things. I wish that that comes with the loyalty. It's a double-edged sword. You know, I'm all about relationships.
Yeah.
You know, I've never been one of these people that can just cut off, you know.
Sure.
Like if I've done somebody wrong, I tend to try to go above and beyond to try to make those things right, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
It may not affect them as much as it affects me.
Yeah.
And that's a big thing. I get in my head a lot of times and I worry.
Age will help you fix that.
Looking forward to it.
I know it's like, but it's just a weird thing. There's a lot of this shit, like that I interview people, like you're 20 years younger than me. And I don't feel 20 years older than you. I must say, maybe I'm very overly optimistic about myself, but, some of the things that I hear people say that are, you know, a little bit younger than me, I remember, and it's just so, it's a weird thing, man. Some of that stuff just works itself out. I'll tell you a story about biting fingernails. I bit my fingernails down to the quick for 50 years, probably. About 3 years ago, I went to a Thursday night concert at a pretty popular bar, outdoor bar here called Skipper's Smokehouse here in Tampa. And anybody that's a musician listening to it has probably played it. That's come through Tampa at some point. And they had a Grateful Dead band there. It's not too long ago, 3 years ago, I was with both of my sons actually. So they were probably, I don't know, 25 and 23 at the time. And okay. I said, man, I need to call that guy up and start playing guitar. Cause I kind of started guitar a couple of times and I never really stuck it out. And I said, I need to start it. And then I need to stop biting my nails. Cause if I got to play guitar, and it was the weirdest thing, man, that weekend, I just stopped biting my nails.
Yeah.
Like, it was like a smoking a cigarette for breakfast, except it was my nails, you know, it was all, and I just stopped. And
I think that's what it was for me is both of my parents smoked growing up.
Yeah, mine too.
So I'm guessing maybe that's where it came from. Like I never was a smoker, but maybe I bit my fingernails because of that nicotine addiction. Maybe it's in me somehow.
I don't know. I used to smoke for years, many years ago, but I just stopped. And I'm so grateful because it's like, wow.
If I get on a kick, it's like sometimes I won't do it. It'll be all good. And then something will happen. Like even a movie, man, if I see an intense movie, sometimes I'll be like, eh.
Yeah. It's a habit, man. Believe me, I know I did it for years. Now, if I catch my hand wandering in my mouth, I'm like, oh, gross. I've never stopped anything that easily. Like when I quit smoking cigarettes, when I quit drinking Diet Coke, nothing has ever been that easy. So sure. I was glad I got one break is what it was, at least, you know. Even a broken clock's right twice a day, you know.
That's right.
Happiest moment or time in your life, Charlie?
The day my son was born.
How old is he now?
He's 6 now.
Congratulations, man.
Thank you.
Flip side, darkest period of time in your life? If you're comfortable answering, if not, that's totally
fine. No, that's totally fine. It was probably the Bad Horse time period.
When y'all got signed to the label?
Yeah, when we got signed to the label. Like I said, I wouldn't change anything about it. There's a lot of great things that came out of it, but there was things about myself that I learned that I was not capable of.
Mm.
And there was things about people around me that I didn't know that was capable of. So yeah, it was one of those things where it was definitely a dark time. I never was a person that drank very much. I would have a drink or two. I was fine. I found myself drinking a lot during that time. Mm-hmm. So yeah. And then, when I met my wife, or prior to meeting my wife, I kind of made a personal commitment and, a declaration and changed it from there. And then having, you know, marrying my wife and everything, you know, marriage is hard itself, but man, I wouldn't change that for anything. Cause, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you if it wasn't for her and, even her family, you know, her dad is like, he's my best friend.
That's awesome, man.
Him and I are very, very tight and we've had our ups and downs, but man, I couldn't trade him for anything. He's just as important as my wife. So
that's wonderful.
And they really taught me a lot about, that part of family, even my son, seeing him grow, that taught me a lot about rebuilding, I guess, and figuring yourself out and how to overcome things, you know.
That's nice, man. How long have y'all been together, you and your wife?
8 years in April.
Congratulations, man. Good for you.
Thank you.
You have any non-musical superpowers?
Oh man. Non-musical superpowers. I'm a pretty good salesman.
Are you really?
Believe it or not. Yeah.
Good for you, man.
I've done a lot of sales work in the past and I've been a top guy for a couple different companies I work for, you know, nothing like huge, you know, but, you know, selling $100,000, garages and stuff.
Good for you, man. Man, I think that's the most important business skill anybody could have.
Yeah, absolutely.
By
far. You learn real quick. You can't quit. You know, you gotta stay the course, and you just gotta keep punching.
You got a lot of no's, man.
Yeah, I would sell these garages and design them too with customers, and sometimes it'd take 2 years to get them to finally drop $50,000 just to put a down payment.
Yeah.
You got to stick with it, man.
Good for you, man. You have any hobbies outside of music, Charlie?
Man, there's things that come and go, but man, I don't really have time for hobbies.
Yeah.
You know, it's like one of those things where I get so hell bent on having to learn music, and I'm a bit of a perfectionist and, have a hard time. I'm one of those people that I have a hard time walking away from something. Like I constantly have to, it'll be a song that I'm having to learn. And I listen to songs a little bit differently. Like, I mean, I'll go down to like listening to the drum parts and, it's one of those things where I want to get it perfect. And then I'll probably fail at it. Like, you know, I'll play Friday night and do a song I hadn't done before and I'll probably just, you know, butcher it, but it does, trust me. I forget who it was that said it on this podcast, but you should have heard what I was going to play or something like that.
Jack Pearson said it. Jack Pearson said that. That was great, man. Cause this guy is like, he's the guy literally that when I was, you know, not the early stages, but you know, like a couple of hundred episodes of the show, people, man, you know, oh, you talked to this guy. Good. Have you talked to Jack Pearson?
Yeah.
and it was funny because like a bunch of people had turned me on to him and then I met somebody and they were saying, you need to get Jack. And I said, man, I've called that dude a couple of times. I can't, you know, I'm not like a life insurance salesman. If you want to come on the show, great, but I'm not going to be like, hey, can I get an appointment? You know, you gotta get your blood test drawn to get this life insurance. And he goes, well, what's the phone number you got? And he goes, man, you got the wrong number. And I just made one phone call and he goes, oh, hey, he goes, yeah, I'll come on your show.
That's cool.
Yeah. And it was Joe Glazer. If you're listening to this, Joe, thank you very much. Yeah. Joe Glazer.
Yeah, man. I'm definitely that guy. Like I try to do a great job on every show I ever play, but there's some times where you just walk off and somebody will come up to you and man, you sounded great. And it's like he said, you know, you should have heard what I was trying to do.
Yeah. That's funny, man. That is, it's funny because I would be lying dramatically if I said I remember everything that everybody says, not by a long shot, but I remember that specifically because it was so ironic coming from him because he's such a great player, man.
Oh, he's a monster.
And he practices and he's so incredibly disciplined. There's two or three guys that literally live and breathe for guitar, and he's one of them. John Prestia, who's Tim McGraw's guitar tech, Jim Campolongo, maybe 10 guys. I mean, not to take anything away from anybody else's passion, but there are just a small handful of guys that, like, there's this connect, like, it's like breathing for them, you know?
Yeah.
And, so
Jack's a hero.
Yeah, he's awesome. Two more questions, man. This is a funny one, or a lighthearted one. Most embarrassing or funniest thing that's happened to you on stage or in the studio?
Okay. I normally save this one for private, but
this is for the party after you've had two drinks.
it's definitely that. So I was a kid, and my cousin Zach and I had a little band together, and I was playing drums during this time, and we went into the studio in Griffin, Georgia, and it was a cover band. They were having rehearsal, and my aunt was friends with them or something. And I think I was like 13, 14 years old, and they were going to cut a demo of a song that we wrote together. And my cousin was on guitar, I was on drums, and the guy was playing drums. He's like, "Hey man," he's like, "watch out for my seat." He's like, "'cause they don't have the rubber bottoms on them. And it's kind of a weird scene. If you're not careful, you know, it'll fall down on you or something." I'm like, "This is a punk kid. I don't know." I'm like, "All right, whatever." And these guys played like a lot of Metallica and stuff like that. And I get on there and it's just this big monster set. You know, I'm feeling pretty courageous. And I get over there. We start cutting this track. And for some reason, I mean, this chair was really screwed up. It falls back, fall back, the chair flips up, and the actual leg is just this sharp piece and goes right up between my legs.
Oh my God.
And so I had we won't go into too much more detail.
Holy smokes.
I'm like a 14-year-old kid grabbing himself.
Ah! Oh man, sorry about that.
That session was over. Lucky I had a kid, but yeah, that was that's the most embarrassing. Here's all these 30-year-old grown men like laughing at me, and they're at the same time trying to help me. Like, "God, man, we told you, watch out for that chair." I'm like, "Get a new chair." But I'll never forget that because I was so embarrassed. Smokes.
Wow. Wow. Well,
yep.
That's is not as embarrassing as some other ones I've heard, to be honest.
Oh,
with you.
I'm sure.
Last question, brother. Anything you regret that you have not done or you regret not doing that you would have liked to so far?
Not playing my own music live. I'm trying to figure that one out. Anybody's listening and has some direction for me. You know, the big thing is a lot of these groups are pay to play, like with the publicists and stuff, like, or maybe it's not publicists, but they go out and they'll help book your shows, but you got to put so much money up front for them to go find you these shows. And there's no guarantee that they'll find you these shows. So you could dish out $5,000 real easy over a 3 to 6 months period. And I'm one of those guys where I don't mind asking for help, obviously, but I'm not going to ask guys to travel and,
yeah,
not pay them, and I still have to make a living.
Sure.
You know, so it's like caught in a hard place. And, you know, so I'm trying to find someone to give me that direction on how can I get my music out there, you know, and start playing it. And part of this next album that I'm working on, I'm also going to be raising money to help fund a publicist and booking and stuff like that. Cause it's really a lot of pay to play, man.
Yeah.
And I know that I'll have to pay musicians before I pay myself, which is fine. I don't mind that. But I got to at least pay the musicians.
Absolutely.
And I would love to take Leroy Dean with any, you know, any other guys that played on a hand here. Fun. But gotta pay them, man. I'm not gonna do that to my players, and they're great. So offering them $100 is kind of a joke.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, man, I hope you figure out how to work that out for sure. And anybody has any ideas, you know, hit up Charlie on social media or something. Hey, man, let me tell people where they could find you. First of all, it's Charlie Gilbert, and you can see his website. He's got a really nice website. It's at charlesgilbertmusic.com. Gilbert, G-I-L-B-E-R-T, of course, Charles Gilbert Music. On Charlie's website, if you go to the tab that says 2020, that's next year when his album's going to be released. He has a fundraising campaign there. If you are interested in helping him and contributing to him, please do so. And I would encourage you to check out his first record, Tall Tales, because I would suspect you'd be a lot more motivated to support what he's doing after you hear what he's done already. And you could find all that information on his website. Also, he's active on social media. Links to everything are on his charlesgilbertmusic.com. Again, it's Instagram, Facebook. And Charlie's also available for lessons. He does in-person lessons if you're in the Murfreesboro area. That's where you live, right?
Yep.
And he does Skype lessons as well. So if you're interested in that, go to the contact tab on Charles Gilbert Music and hit him up. Please be respectful of his time. And good luck. And if you get together.
Also session work too. If you need any guitar stuff, yeah. You can reach out to me through the website as well. Happy to do any guitar work for you.
Absolutely. Anybody needs sessions, let them know. Dude, thank you very much for everything. I really appreciate you. You're a super sweet guy. And I'm sure we'll be in touch for a long time to come. I'm excited about your next record coming out.
Thank you, Craig. Appreciate your friendship, man.
Likewise. Thanks so much for taking the time to come on the show, Charlie. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please share it with a friend on your social media channels. We appreciate your support and your help with this. Thanks so much to Charlie Gilbert for spending time with us. Please support Charlie and his music at charlesgilbertmusic.com and check out his last record, Tall Tales. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.